The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Start by a list of 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Friday Morning Space Show program. I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. And another great show today, and as we lead up to the 50th anniversary of Apollo, lots more about that. And every time I talk to someone, I learn new history about Apollo and Apollo 11. So I find it not only interesting, but productive and very informative, and I'm convinced that you will feel the same after today's program. I'll introduce our guest in just a minute. A couple of quick announcements. We're using the 60-minute format today. So if you do have an email or a phone call that you would like to get into our guest, watch your clock to make sure that you call or email while we're still on the air. And we appreciate that. Please note that our Sunday program is a regular program this week. Excuse me. But we've added in a special program for Monday evening. Excuse me. This is going to debrief what went on at ISDC. And there were some pretty exciting and informative talks and events that happened. So Rod and Aggie, you're back with us from the National Space Society. Hope my voice holds up. And that's going to be a special Monday show. Then we have a special Tuesday show with Dr. Jurist, who we haven't heard from for a while, but he's going to sort of let it all hang out as to his perspectives and opinions about what's going on in space, the moon, Mars, all about what we talk about all the time. And then we're off for several days for the July 4th holiday weekend. So for today, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, there are no call screeners, so please, be patient, let it ring, and I'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. And then email drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com, and you can also post on our blog. And to do that, it's thespaceshow.com. All the way over to the far right is the upcoming show menu. Click on the first show listed, which is today's program with our guest, Charles Fishman. And blog comments and questions are all the way at the bottom of that page. As soon as you hit send or post, then I'll get it, and I can integrate your question or comment into the program. But do remember that the telephone is our preferred way, and this is a talk show, which really implies that we're all talking, not emailing or texting. So we do prefer your phone calls, 1-866-687-7223. Don't forget to check out our website newsletter, and it will be updated on Sunday, after the Sunday Space Show program, but it is current, and we've added a lot more dates to the upcoming section, so scroll down, and we're booking into October already and toward the end of the year, which is pretty amazing to me. Time really does fly fast. And then in addition, everything we do is archived. You can listen right off of our website. You can download the programs very quickly. If you want the email version of our newsletter, goes out at 6 a.m. California time Monday morning, please let me know your email address. Remember, we have a store if you're interested in Space Show logo wear. And the easiest way to access that store is on any of our pages of our website. Click on Pepper Listening to the Space Show over on the right side, and that will take you to our Cafe Press store. There's also in the upper left menu, Listen Live instructions. So this tells you how to listen to live programs like we're doing right now, how to listen to podcasts, including Alexa, and archives, which are MP3s, on our website. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Please do remember we are a listener-supported program, which means that your support keeps the space show going. We're also a nonprofit, 501c3. So if you do donate to us and you pay U.S. federal taxes, you get a tax deduction for your gift. If you're paying California taxes, you also get a California deduction, as we are a public benefit corporation in California. Our parent 501c3 is OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. Check it out, and if you have any questions, please do let me hear from you. And again, the best way to do that, email drspace@thespaceshow.com. There is a PayPal button over on the right side of our homepage for those of you who would like to donate electronically. And that button also has information for how to pay manually with a check and drop it in the mail. Again, questions, just email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And there's also a huge Amazon button in the center of our homepage, because Amazon offers two great programs to support nonprofits. One Giant Leap, the Space Show, is registered as an Amazon nonprofit. So if you use either of the two methods, if you click on that button, you'll see those two methods. Amazon donates a portion of your purchase price to the Space Show. So for those of you that are Amazon users, as am I, it's a great way to support the Space Show with your purchases. And we thank Amazon for really, truly good nonprofit support. And hopefully you'll choose One Giant Leap as the nonprofit you want Amazon to support. So I'm happy to introduce to all of you Charles Fishman. He is an author. His new book, One Giant Leap, The Impossible Mission That Flew Us to the Moon. And Mr. Fishman is an award-winning journalist, a New York Times best-selling author of The Walmart Effect and The Big Thirst. He started reporting on the U.S. space program as a WAPO reporter covering the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster, and has written about space for The Atlantic, Smithsonian, and Fast Company. He has been a staff member of the Orlando Sentinel, the News and Observer in Raleigh, North Carolina, and Fast Company magazine. He lives in Washington, D.C., and he is part of the reporting for One Giant Leap. He flew in zero gravity, which I would certainly like to do. And he has a website for the book, onegiantleap.space. And it's a Simon & Schuster book. Charles, welcome to the Space Show. How are you today?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me, David.
Apollo, I mean, all of us know the general story, at least everybody on the Space Show audience knows most of the story and the general story, but there's always details and things that authors such as yourself, especially you in your book, pop on us that at least I'm not familiar with, and maybe a lot of other listeners are not familiar with as well. So one of the things that caught my attention was, and maybe I've known it, maybe I've forgotten it, I don't know, is that President Kennedy was not necessarily going to deliver the Rice University speech, and was planning on just maybe delivering it to Congress. So that Rice University speech is still an inspiration today. I have an excerpt of it in the vision part of the Space Show, which I play on every Space Show program. Oh, my God, what would I use? What would others do if he had only delivered a short little comment to Congress? Would that have made a difference?
Well, okay, we have to separate two things. The Rice University speech is that incredibly eloquent, really, I think of it as the sort of foundational document of exploring space. It's beautifully written. He delivered it beautifully. That was September 1962. The speech that launched us to the moon, the speech that really launched this incredible race through the 1960s to do something hugely dramatic, that was a speech to Congress in May 1961, May 25th, 1961. That was the speech he almost didn't give. And in some ways, it was not an eloquent sort of explanation of why flying in space is both uniquely American and human destiny. That was a much more pragmatic speech. But we wouldn't have gone to the moon without it. In fact, of course, Yuri Gagarin had just orbited the Earth for the Russians, and 5 days after that, the U.S.-backed invasion at the Bay of Pigs in Cuba, headed for Cuba, and within 2 or 3 days, Fidel Castro had defeated the U.S.-backed guerrillas. And so there had been, literally in the space of 7 days, there had been two global humiliations of the United States in the middle of a very serious Cold War. We kind of think somehow of the Cold War now as almost like an athletic rivalry, you know, UNC and Duke in basketball. It was nothing like that. There was nothing cold about the Cold War. Tens of thousands of people died in all kinds of episodes over 40 years. And Kennedy felt like the Soviet success in space was persuading the world that the Russians were as good or better at science and technology and space as the Americans, which clearly wasn't true, but they were doing better in space. And so there was a month-long, a sort of furious month-long study of how the United States could get back in the game, could, as to use Kennedy's words, leapfrog the Soviet space effort, and the internal conclusion, and we could talk a little bit about this if you want to, but the internal conclusion was the only way to do it was to go to the moon. But the speech that Kennedy gave on May 25th was actually, he called it a second State of the Union speech. He had given a State of the Union speech back in January, but things hadn't gone well in that first 3 months, including Gagarin and the Bay of Pigs. And Kennedy wanted to reset the politics and to say to people, we are determined to be the leaders of freedom in the world. And so he gave it was a nationally televised speech. It was given midday, 12:30 on May 25th, and to both houses of Congress. And the last section of that speech, literally 32 minutes in, 8 minutes just near the end of the speech, that was the part about going to the moon. Everything that came before that was how to reestablish American military superiority around the world. And then came, and by the way, we all know that there's a battle in space as well as a battle on Earth, as well as a battle in Vietnam. And so we need to step up and be the real space power. We need to make sure space is a place for freedom, not for Soviet influence. And so I propose that we go to the moon by the end of the decade. And there, that was the only news the next day. He gave a 45-minute speech, 39 minutes of which was about everything but space, and the only headlines after that speech were about Kennedy and the United States leaping to the moon and racing the Russians there. So it turned out to be critically important. But that speech was delivered on a Thursday. As late as Wednesday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Kennedy was just going to send the paper text of the speech to Congress and say, here's my Cold War proposals. And it was, in fact, Vice President Lyndon Johnson who said, Mr. President, if you're going to have an impact with this speech, you need to deliver it. And so you can imagine all the effort that goes into a nationwide broadcast speech, a quote-unquote second State of the Union. Literally in less than 20 hours, they had to get Congress to pass resolutions inviting the president to come up. That was Wednesday afternoon. And then Kennedy had to pause in his duties and rehearse a speech he had not intended to give. And so in the written text, the text that he delivered, his speech text was 80 pages long. So this was not a brief undertaking. But what's so striking is that if that speech had simply been packed up as 6 copies to be sent to Congress, where a clerk might or might not have read it out loud to a room where there might or might not have been senators and congressmen listening, it's possible we wouldn't have gone to the moon. Because it was the kind of dynamism, the charisma of the way Kennedy delivered that rallying cry. We should go to the moon by the end of the decade. This will be the hardest thing we've ever done. That's what got people's attention. That's what dominated headlines literally from California to Florida the next day. Big banner headlines, we're going to the moon. And so the fact that he almost didn't give the speech is one of those moments that sort of makes you wonder, what would we have landed on the moon July 20th, 1969, if he had said, it's got my proposals in it, just send it up there, we got a lot going on.
You know, one of the things that caught my attention when you were speaking just a minute ago, I had to have a smile, and you said Kennedy wanted to sort of reset us, given the problems that had been happening. And it seems like we keep hearing and have been hearing in the news for, I don't know, a decade or more, we're going to push the reset button with the Russians. It's like we're always trying to reset. Maybe Kennedy was the first. I don't know if he was the first or if he followed other reset attempts.
He was definitely not the first to try and push the reset button, but he was resetting in the other direction at that moment. he was resetting to make sure that this was the battle between communism and freedom, between authoritarianism and democracy, between communism and capitalism, and nations literally lined themselves up with either the Soviets or the Americans. And so this was not a trivial matter at all. This was the moment. The Bay of Pigs invasion, of course, was followed a year later by nuclear missiles being put in Cuba and the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was followed that summer by the erection of the Berlin Wall, by the Russians saying, if you live in Germany and you live on, quote-unquote, our side, you're not getting out. So the battle for freedom was real, and Kennedy and lots of American leaders considered the Russian lead in space to be devastating for the reputation of the power of freedom and the power of capitalism. And we sort of have a tendency to kind of shrug and say, well, reputation, humiliation, that's all kind of soft stuff. But in that era, it was not soft stuff. It was part of figuring out what kind of system your country was going to have and what kind of system your people were going to live under.
I have an email for you already from Alex in Phoenix, and he says, Mr. Fishman, we hear many of the same arguments today about our current space program and going to the moon. In fact, often I hear, even with guests on the space show, that going to the moon is about freedom, what culture, what kind of system do we want establishing settlements and going forward in space, especially on the moon, for example. Do you want what communist China offers? Do you want what the United States offers for freedom and democracy? The same thing over and over again after all these years. Do you also see parallels? Do you see differences? We don't seem to graduate to different arguments.
Well, I mean, that's actually a very astute comment. But I think there's a big difference. There's a whole set of questions about how to think about what happens when you set up an actual base on a planet. How's the base going to be run? But the truth is, you know, we're probably a long way from having to worry about what kind of government we're going to have on moon settlements. Although, as the listener says, it's the time to think about how to set that up is well in advance, so you don't have to sort of backtrack and unravel something that's in place. I think, and we can talk about this at the end. I'm eager to talk more about Apollo, but I don't think what's exciting. I think this is the most exciting moment in space travel in 50 years. I think it's as exciting as the mid 60s. But what's exciting is not this tussle about whether we're going back to the moon, whether we'll have an orbiting moon base from which then we will go down to the surface, whether we're going to do it by 2024 or not. Those are all government programs. What's going to make space exciting is sustainable space, and sustainable space is going to be driven by companies, by private enterprise, and that's what's happening a little closer to home. There's not much economic argument right now for being on the moon, and there are all kinds of things we might get out of that. And I don't think going to the moon is necessary to validate the value of American values anymore. But I think what's going to be exciting, and we can talk about this a little later, is what's happening in near-Earth orbit. That's what's going to make this a really interesting and productive time in the life of space travel.
Well, I'll be sure to allow time because I want to hear what you have to say about that, especially near-Earth orbit, because there is a lot happening up there, or hopefully up there. So we definitely need to talk about it. When you sat down to write your book, did you have a specific agenda or perspective that you wanted to cover and focus? And were you able to actually do that as you started researching and writing the book, or did your plans change?
That's a great question. In fact, I wouldn't say I had an agenda, but I did have a perspective. The Apollo story is well told. The 12 men who have walked on the moon have between them written 15 books. So if you just wanted to read the books just by the people who have actually been to the moon, that would take you a month, and you wouldn't be taking notes. You would just be reading as fast as you could, one book every 2 days. And then there's literally a library of books. So if you're going to sit down and say, I too am going to write a book about the race to the moon in the 1960s, you do have to, first of all, you have to be humble and acknowledge the work that's come before you, a lot of which is great. And also you have to say, I'm going to add something. I want my readers to get something out of this book that I'm writing that they couldn't get by just pulling a book off the shelf or going to a used bookstore or going to the library and finding one of the other books that's been written. And that's hard. Here was my mission. I think that the space program in the 60s has almost exclusively been written from the perspective of the astronauts. And that's appropriate. The astronauts were heroic. They were smart. They were determined. They were courageous. They're also charismatic. Their stories are fun to tell. But there was literally an army of 410,000 people back on Earth who made it possible for the astronauts to do what they did. And those people, it turns out, were bold and courageous and determined as well. And the astronauts would be the first to tell you that. They were the first to say, we are the public face. We are the tip of the spear. But if we couldn't do any of this without the people back on Earth. And so I wanted to write a book that captured that creativity, that sense of urgency, what was necessary back here to get the astronauts to the moon. There's this sort of historical conventional wisdom. There's a lot of historical conventional wisdom about Apollo that I think is misguided or simply wrong, but one piece of it is, it was just an engineering effort. It wasn't like the Manhattan Project. We didn't have to make any fundamental breakthroughs in science. People just had to work hard. And forgive me, but that's crap. there were 10,000 problems that had to be solved in order to get astronauts to the moon. And in May 1961, we didn't even know what 5,000 of them were because we hadn't started on the first 5,000. And there were breakthroughs of every kind that had to be, yes, engineered, but that didn't make them less daunting or the actual work, the actual insight and creativity, any less important and less meaningful. And so that story to me is as captivating as the astronaut story. And that's a story where I felt I could add something. You know, in modern America, it's often hard to build a big building or a bridge in 8 years. And we know how to build buildings and bridges. So how did we invent travel to the moon in the space of 8 years? That's the story I wanted to tell.
Well, you didn't have design and review committees and this, that, and the other, and all the policy crap that you have to go through to build the bridge or the high building, because it isn't the technology and engineering. It's, you know, all the paperwork, the policy, the approvals, the permits.
And the project management.
And the project management.
And a lot of that. And NASA doesn't get credit, but NASA did a brilliant job of that. And so understanding that piece of it, too. In fact, 2 weeks before Apollo 11 launched, Fortune magazine did a cover story on Apollo's brilliant project management. How do you get a government agency to do a government project on budget, on time? They didn't know it would be a success, but it turns out to be a success. What does that look like? And Fortune magazine did a cover story saying, assuming Apollo 11 is a success, one of the great breakthroughs of the last 8 years has been NASA's creation of a system to manage a sprawling project that, by the way, did not get out of control, that did not...
Do you think if these 400,000 people had access to the technology and computer power and all of what we all walk around with in our pockets today, back then there would have been 10,000 problems to solve, or would it have been a whole different ballgame?
You know, I would say it's right up the middle. It's hard to imagine that we would have had the computers without having some of the things that have come along with that. But look, when Kennedy said on May 25th, 1961, let's go to the moon, I think your listeners know this. There was no rocket powerful enough anywhere to go to the moon.
Right.
There was no spaceship that could land on the moon. There were no spacesuits. There was no, as you say, there was no computer small enough and powerful enough to navigate to the moon. There were two really interesting arguments right then, right at that moment. One was, will human brains work in zero gravity? That was an actual argument inside NASA. It seems silly now, but we didn't know how your brain would work in weightlessness. And so if you couldn't think, it was going to make going to the moon harder. There was an argument at MIT about the math necessary to navigate to the moon. And the argument was, this math is really hard. Can we do the math in real time fast enough to make the course changes we'll need to make to get to the moon? Will we be able to keep up with what we need to do? Now, those kind of questions kind of look, they almost look silly now, but they were serious questions debated by serious people because these problems were hard and we hadn't solved them yet.
You made a point in the book that I wanted to ask you about, and I mentioned it before we went on air, where you said 1 hour of space flight for Apollo required 1 million hours of work in the background. How did you come up with that? And I'm assuming all of that hours of work is done by the 400,000 plus people that were all working on projects to go to the moon, right?
That's what the 400,000 people were doing. So how did I come up with that? What a great question. You know, one of the things NASA is very good at is publishing numbers. There's a book by a guy named Orloff called Apollo by the Numbers. It's a 400-page book that is literally nothing but statistics about the Apollo moon mission. Almost anything you want to know about Apollo is in there. And NASA has published statistical compilations of its larger framework during the 50s and 60s, the first 10 years, the second 10 years. So you can look up how many people were employed by NASA, how many people were employed by contractors every 6 months throughout the entire period. So I did a very basic but sort of diligent calculation that no one's ever done before. I added up the total number of work hours that Apollo required from the moment it was announced in 1961 until the program was over at the end of 1972. And if you do that calculation, it's quite astonishing for your listeners if they want to know. The number is 2.8 billion hours.
Wow.
But if you take the number of flight hours, so there were 11 Apollo missions, and the total amount of flying time is 2,500 hours. It's actually 2,502 hours. And that includes, you know, being launched, flying to the moon, walking around, driving around, coming home, splashing down. That's all the flight time of those missions. 2,500 hours, that's about 100 days.
So that's launch to recovery.
Launch to recovery. Every one of those hours required 1 million hours of work back on Earth. Just take the total number of hours, divide by the total number of flight hours. But pause a minute. What is 1 million hours of work? The average human being does 100,000 hours of work in their lifetime. So So each hour of Apollo flight as preparation required the entire work lives of 10 people. Imagine doing something for 1 hour. Imagine being allowed to do something for 1 hour that 10 people had worked their entire careers to get you ready to do. And then when that hour was over, the next hour began, and 10 people had also given their entire careers to getting you ready for that next hour. It is a totally unprecedented level of preparation and intensity for any project in human history. 10 times the scale of the Panama Canal, 3 times the scale of the Manhattan Project. It dwarfs the pyramids, although hard to compare to the pyramids. It even dwarfs the work that went into the pyramids. So that's kind of what inspired me. Let's understand what the million hours was. One of the striking things about Apollo, one of the things that I found so surprising was the amount of work that was done by hand. We had the ability to solve problems, to invent the technology we needed, but then we often could not manufacture it. And so the Apollo spacesuits are brilliant, tiny little spacecraft for one person, brilliantly designed, lots of technology, 21 layers, each spacesuit 21 layers. Every stitch of every spacesuit layer sewn by hand. The Apollo computers were the smallest, fastest, most nimble computers ever created to that point in time in American history, in world history, in fact. But we didn't have the ability to make the memory of the computers using manufacturing techniques. And so literally every wire, every one and zero of every Apollo computer was sewn by hand by women sitting at looms, sophisticated looms, but looms in a factory run by Raytheon in Waltham, Massachusetts. It's sort of mind-boggling that the advanced spaceflight computers had to be woven by hand like tapestries, their guts, their memory. And so that's where the million hours came from, was we created ideas and technologies that we then didn't have the ability to implement, and everybody just shrugged and said, who cares? Let's just keep going.
Email from Beverly in Chicago, and she says, at the time this was all happening, was there any awareness of this kind of ratio of work hours to flight time? Was this ever discussed, or is this from post-Apollo era analysis?
Never saw a reference to anything like this in my reading, and I read widely, but I obviously only just peeled off a slice. But look, it was NASA understood how many people worked at the contractors, how many people worked at NASA, what all that was costing. NASA understood the level of intensity, and there were really dramatic and in some ways very sad costs. One of the places with the highest divorce rate in the entire nation during the 1960s was Brevard County, Florida, which is the county that includes Cape Kennedy and the Space Center. And so up at MIT, among the group working on the computer, those people worked 6 and 7 days a week, week after week after week, for literally years. Half the senior staff working on Apollo for MIT got divorced during that period. So I think the level of intensity was understood. They were the ones living through it. They were the ones doing it. I don't think it was quantified in quite this way, nor do I think they would have cared. I think what's powerful to me about that number is looking back. You know, whatever, you see the picture in your 10th grade history book, okay, we went to the moon. That number, 10, the entire work lives of 10 people for every hour, that makes you wonder, what were those people doing? Why did it require that level of work? There's a story there. That's what's so intriguing about it to me.
You tell a story about the Russians trying to steal the moon landing thunder with their own mission for lunar sample return just a couple of days before Apollo 11 landed on the moon. Tell us about that.
You know, this was the fun for me in doing the book was every day I stumbled on a surprise. And this isn't some kind of secret, never before told story, but it is really a remarkable tale. Just 2 days, 3 days before Apollo 11 was launched, the Russians launched a robotic probe called Luna 15. And when Collins, Armstrong, and Aldrin arrived in orbit around the moon, Luna 15 was orbiting. Luna 15 was specifically designed to land on the moon, dig, drill a hole to get untainted lunar samples that hadn't, you know, the surface right where the probe landed, of course, would have had rocket fuel around it. Dig down, get some soil, get some rocks, and then the upper stage of Luna 15, just like a miniature version of the lunar module. In fact, the upper stage was going to blast back off and race back to the Soviet Union, and then the Russians could announce that they had rocks from the moon. And the timing was done in such a way that they expected to beat Armstrong and Aldrin and Collins back to Earth with their samples. And, of course, one of the reasons for doing it was we didn't know how Apollo 11 would turn out, right? If it hadn't been a success and the Russians had gotten moon rocks, they could say, not only did we do it, we did it successfully. And so they wanted to be on stage at the same moment, and they were racing to do it, and it wasn't a trivial undertaking on their part. This was the first time Russian and American spacecraft had been at the moon at the same time. NASA was actually a little nervous, and Frank Borman had just returned from the first ever visit by an American astronaut to the Soviet Union. He spent 8 days there. And NASA asked Borman to call up his new buddies in the Soviet Union and get some information about Luna 15. This was all on the front page of the New York Times day after day. Many stories about this. And the Russians provided the flight coordinates for Luna 15 and the radio frequencies so that NASA could be assured there was going to be no interference. In the end, the Russians were aiming at a spot on the moon that they apparently didn't understand that well, and Luna 15 slammed into a mountain that they didn't know was there. It's not really that funny, but slammed into a mountain that they didn't know was there, going 400 miles an hour. So their effort to one-up the United States, you know, failed in spectacular fashion, but they were trying. And so right to the very end, there was something of a race, at least in the minds of the space people on both sides.
Amazing. So it would be fun to play what would have happened if, and then they had landed and successfully completed their mission and had not crashed. What kind of impact do you think that might have had, or how would history look today?
Yeah. Well, they, of course, did go on to put a couple of robotic probes successfully down, probes that were just like Luna 15 and bring back rocks. And, you know, I guess the what if would have depended on whether everything else came out the same, right? If they had done that, but Apollo 11 had gone just as it went, I don't think it would have mattered. Not to take anything away from Soviet space scientists. There's no competition between landing a robotic probe, and returning it, and human beings walking around on the moon and returning with samples. So I don't think it would have played out any differently. And you know, in the end, even if you want to do the most extreme what if Americans hadn't made it to the moon when we did, and the Russians, the Soviets had somehow figured out how to put human beings on the moon before the United States, I find it almost, you know, queasy inducing to imagine the Soviet flag, the red hammer and sickle, on the moon instead of the stars and stripes, the symbol of oppression and authoritarianism, and you know, the subjugation of the individual to the state, instead of the American flag has complicated symbolism, but it does stand for freedom. It does stand for taking hold of your own life. But they launched Yuri Gagarin first. It did not, in the end, save the Soviet system. So I don't think anything in geopolitical terms, I don't think it would have come out differently. But I don't think the symbolism of the Soviet Union landing people on the moon first would have been good back on Earth. I think it would have sent the wrong message about the importance of those core human values. So, you know, that's a little airy for a conversation about space, but that was part of what was going on at the time.
And of course, that was mentioned earlier in our discussion with people using the same arguments that we don't want the Chinese on the moon for the same reason, and you know, or at least not first. So, to a lot of people, we're in a moon race today, and to a lot of other people, they say hogwash. We're not in a moon race, and no reason to be fearful of the Chinese getting there. We've already been there. So, as was said earlier, a lot of the same rhetoric and argument is used, even if the background is different.
So. Well, the arguments about space travel, I was so struck by how little the arguments have changed. On the one hand, exploring is part of human nature. We don't know what we're going to discover. You know, I opened my book with the sentence, "The moon has a smell." And again, this was another one of these moments where I stumbled on something that revealed that moon dirt that was tracked back into the lunar module by the astronauts, when they snapped off their helmets, the entire interior of the lunar module had a distinctive smell, the smell of sort of burned fireplace ashes, or as Buzz Aldrin put it, the smell of the air after a fireworks show, a burned sort of gunpowdery smell. Well, there's no robot that could have told you that wonderful detail. There's no robot that could have told you what the moon smells like. And so there are reasons to send human beings, and those reasons are inarguable. The flip side is sending human beings costs a huge amount of money. It costs between 10 and 100 times what sending robotic probes costs. You can do a lot more, quote-unquote, science if you leave the human beings out of it. And those arguments, literally in 1963, the conversation was the same. And I guess the key is perspective. One of the historical, quote-unquote, truths about Apollo is that it was really expensive. It wasn't expensive. It wasn't expensive at all. In dollars spent at the time of Apollo, that is in each year, the total was $19.2 billion.
Per year?
No, total $19.2
okay.
billion. Dollars. There were 2 years of fighting in Vietnam, two individual years, each of which cost more than $19.2 billion. So could we afford to go to the moon? Well, compared to fighting in Vietnam, we sure could, because we spent more in Vietnam in 12 months than going to the moon cost total. We spent more as a country during the years of Apollo. Buying cigarettes cost twice what flying to the moon cost. We spent $40 billion buying cigarettes during that time, $19.2 billion going to the moon. Could we afford it? We certainly could. That doesn't mean it was the right use of money, but it's just silly to keep saying it was expensive. People say, oh my God, it was 5% of the federal budget. Well, 5% is not that much. I'm not sure what in my own personal life budget each day, what things I spend 5% on. But 5% is not the kind of thing that makes you think, uh-oh, I better cut it back to 3.5%. So it was expensive, but it was not, it was real money. But it was not the kind of money that was squeezing out other kinds of things. And so what I would say is I think we have the money to do what we want to do, both robotically and the NASA missions that don't have people. The discoveries they make are incredible. The people who do that science are amazing, and it is so fun to watch all what the folks at JPL uncover and learn. But there's clearly a role for human exploration. So I don't think there's a contest. I'm not worried about I personally am not worried about the Chinese going to the moon. What I think is important about what the Chinese do is something we're incapable of doing. The Chinese sort of imagine and lay out a 12-year program to do something, and then they do year one and year three and year seven and year nine, slow and steady, and then they get there. And then we sort of look around and say, how did they do that? Well, they did it because we weren't paying attention in year two and year seven. We need to do things in 3 years or we don't do them.
Right.
We're not good at 12-year programs.
in your book, you I found an interesting chapter. Well, I found a lot of interesting chapters. But chapter 5 is the man who saved Apollo. So it's actually a long chapter, but it was very interesting. And again, this is one of your unique perspectives that you bring to things. Can you briefly talk about the man who saved Apollo and what you're talking about?
Sure. So one of my goals was to find people who played key roles, but who haven't really been written about that much. And so in the mid-60s, in 1966, MIT was in charge of designing the Apollo computers, engineering them, and then programming them. Raytheon was in charge of manufacturing them, and MIT watched over that carefully. And by 1966, MIT had written what everybody agreed was brilliant software to fly to the moon, and there was 40% more of it than would fit in the computer. And this was not 2019. You couldn't add a hard drive. You couldn't buy a USB port and buy a USB thing and plug in and keep going. There was no way of adding more memory. The memory was as big as it could be. The computer was as heavy as it could be. Remember, we had the women weaving the memory, so you knew exactly how many ones and zeros you got. And MIT seemed oddly completely unconcerned about the fact that they had written 40% more software than would fit in the computer. NASA was in a panic. NASA wasn't just concerned. Internally, NASA was, in mission control, the senior leadership was talking about MIT preventing NASA from getting to the moon by 1969. And so they sent a guy named Bill Tindall from Houston to Cambridge. Bill Tindall was a modest, self-effacing guy, had served on a World War II destroyer as a young man, came back from the war, went to Brown University, a brilliant mathematician, regarded as a kind of a genius of understanding and figuring out orbital mechanics. How do you get spacecraft into orbit, and then how do you get them back down onto the surface, back into orbit when you need to? He was in charge of mission planning. He was in charge of the script for every second of the space flight. And he was also a guy with a remarkably accessible, funny human personality. So he was an expert, but also incredibly gracious, incredibly funny. Perfect casting. They sent him up to MIT to whip things into shape. And what he discovered up there, the mess he discovered, was even worse than he imagined. And so it took Bill Tindall a year to persuade the MIT people to think differently about their work. There was a famous moment in the summer of 1966 called Black Friday, long before all the other Black Fridays. And Black Friday was where Bill Tindall sat down with the MIT people and said, now we're going to try and cut out 40% of your software, because if we only cut 37%, we're not going to the moon. And the MIT engineers and programmers were just devastated, because here was their beautiful work being left back on Earth. But we wouldn't have gone without it. And he managed to pull off this task with grace and humor. The MIT people really resisted him to begin with. But I went and talked to, dozens of those folks now. And when you talk to them now, they just smile and say, he saved us. He's the reason we ended up succeeding. We'd done brilliant work, but we really weren't paying attention. And so that story is just this wonderful sort of crisis that was resolved in a really amazing way.
So you have a lot of interesting stories and things like that. Also, the G.I. Joe story and the toy inspiring NASA to actually make a moon car. Talk to us about that. I had G.I. Joe toys, but I don't remember any of that. Maybe I've just forgotten it.
Your G.I. Joe did not inspire you to send a car to the moon.
No, they were all about, traditional old-fashioned World War II war.
You were fighting right here on Earth.
That's right. Well, in my bedroom on the floor. So
this too is a wonderful chapter. The NASA lunar vehicles for human beings to drive around in, somehow oddly got assigned to the Marshall Space Flight Center. So Wernher von Braun was in charge of them. And in the early 60s, they actually developed plans and then built prototypes of lunar rover vehicles that were the size of a Honda Odyssey minivan. And they were very cool, but in the end, NASA figured out you'd need an extra Saturn V launch just for the rover. And instead of sort of reimagining it, they killed it. They just said, we don't have time, space, money to do this. We don't need a car on the moon. And two GM engineers, two General Motors engineers, Sam Romano and Ferenc Pavlik, literally used GM's money to keep pursuing the idea of a lunar rover. Sam Romano said, we're going to give the astronauts a car, and it's going to be a GM car, and I am determined that we do this. And they actually talked to Grumman. They went to the folks at Grumman who were designing and building the lunar module, and they said, if we wanted to put a car on the lunar module, where is their storage space and what does it have to be like? And there was actually an extra storage compartment on the outside of the lunar module that was the oddest shaped storage compartment you can imagine. It was in the shape of a piece of pie shaped, but something like 6 feet tall, a 6 foot tall piece of pie, so a wedge, literally a wedge shaped storage space. And they said, you can have that space if you can create a car that can fold up and fit in it. And Ferenc Pavlik was the sort of design engineer at this moment in the project, and he designed exactly what we're familiar with, this kind of lunar dune buggy, so to speak. And it had this ingenious folding mechanism where both the front wheels and the back wheels and the seats all folded down into the middle, and then the wheels themselves folded in, and the whole thing, if you look at it when it's folded up, it looks just like a tall piece of pie. And so they designed this, and then Ferenc Pavlik made what looked like a toy, but was actually a working scale model, about 24 inches long. And his wife even sewed the seats. The seats we're familiar with on the model, they were sewed by his wife. And he and Romano were going to the Marshall Space Flight Center to show it to Wernher von Braun and see if they could persuade him to change his mind. This was February or March of 1969. The moon landings were planned. The equipment had been designed and tested. The astronauts had trained on it. It was a crazy moment to be making this pitch. And as he's headed out the door, Ferenc Pavlik sees his son's new G.I. Joe, and it was called, I think it was called Gemini G.I. Joe, or it might have been called Mercury G.I. Joe, but it was a G.I. Joe in an astronaut outfit, in a spacesuit. And he grabbed his son, as he said, I borrowed my son's G.I. Joe. They headed off to Marshall Space Flight Center, and they did something remarkably ingenious. They hid in the corridor of Marshall Space Flight Center headquarters on the ninth floor outside Wernher von Braun's office down the hall. And the model operated on batteries, it was radio controlled, and they drove the model into Wernher von Braun's office while he was talking on the phone. And he immediately hung up the phone and said, you know, with his thick German accent, what is this? And they came in, everybody was laughing, and they said, this is the car we want you to send to the moon. It's completely different than all those other concepts. It fits. And they talked to him for half an hour. And when they were done, Wernher von Braun literally slapped his hand on his desk and said, we must do this. And it was April. That was April of 1969. And, you know, Wernher von Braun was one of those people inside NASA who had oomph. But that is why those two guys, using GM money, their own vision, we've got to give the astronauts a car. And then this clever sort of marketing, this clever presentation of the idea to Wernher von Braun, that's why we ended up being able to send a car to the moon.
How did you find these stories in your research? I mean, where did you go looking for them, or were you looking for them and you just stumbled on them?
Well, you know, I was always looking for them. One of my favorite little moments in the book is there were only three people authorized to fold Apollo parachutes. And those three people, so 11 missions, three main parachutes on each, 33 parachutes that needed to be folded. In the United States, parachutes that have human lives depending on them, the people who fold them are licensed by the FAA. So these three people were licensed by the FAA to fold Apollo parachutes. They were certified to know how to do it. And they folded, that crew of three folded all the parachutes for all the missions, two men and a woman living in California, part of the parachute crew. And they were forbidden to ever ride in the same car together by NASA because they were considered so valuable and their skills were considered so valuable, NASA couldn't afford to lose them. I stumbled on that story when I was reading old newspapers looking for information about the parachutes. I don't remember what I was chasing, but I was chasing some little detail about how the parachutes were made that eluded me. And here was a story on the front page of the LA Times, a profile of the three people who folded the parachutes from 1966 or 1967. So I was always on the alert for that kind of thing. Ferenc Pavlik, the man who came up with both the design and then the little model that persuaded Wernher von Braun, he's still alive. And there's a wonderful sort of 30 or 40 minute YouTube interview with him, probably from 5 or 6 years ago, about where the design came from, where his ideas came from. He's got the model that he used still at home with him. He can, you know, so it's on camera. So I knew what I was looking for, and I was always alert to those. I didn't skip past the LA Times story that didn't answer my question. I thought, wait a minute, here's an even better story than the thing I'm chasing.
Is Pavlov still able to talk? Would he be a great spatial guest? It sounds like a fascinating story.
You know, I knew how much I was going to write about the lunar rovers, which is that I wrote, you know, the introduction to one chapter is this story. And so I decided not to trouble him by trying to interview him over the phone. I don't know how he does on the telephone now. 5 years ago, 6 years ago, on video camera, he was great. So he might be a good guest. He's very, very cheerful, but he has told the story many, many times at this point.
Do you have his contact information?
I can certainly get you his contact.
Can you, if you could email it, I'd follow it up. I think that'd be a fascinating space shuttle program.
Absolutely.
Amazing. So you have a nose for really ferreting out unusual things that had an impact on Apollo that maybe most of us don't know about.
Well, and I'm a guy who's been writing about the space program since the Space Shuttle Challenger accident. And one thing that I appreciate, I didn't go to MIT. I'm not a trained engineer. I'm not, you know, an aeronautical scientist. I'm not a scientist of any kind. And so I want to understand orbital mechanics. I want to understand the science of how you engineer a heat shield and why the shape of the capsule is the way it is and why the shape of the bell of the lunar module descent engine is the way it is. But I also want to be able to explain that in a way that makes sense to my wife or my mother or, a guy who does software coding for Google or Microsoft and doesn't pay attention to this stuff. And what I've discovered as a journalist is it's the small sort of human details. Someone at NASA was aware enough to say, those three people who fold parachutes, don't ever let them get in a car together because we'll be in trouble. And that to me sort of just, it brings a smile to your face, but it's a reminder that real people did this, there were real stakes, and they understood it at the moment. They weren't confused. And so, you know, the smell is the same thing. You never think about your sense of smell when you think about going to the moon. You might think about how your boot would feel crunching on the dirt. You might think about what it would feel like to have your hands in a spacesuit glove or to be encased in a spacesuit. Smell is not there. And so finding out that the moon had a smell and then being able to say as the first sentence of a book about going to the moon, the moon has a smell, that's a way of reminding people that this is a story that you think you know but you don't actually know. And I'm gonna take you on a journey that fills in some of those wonderful moments that have sort of been lost to history.
You have another story, and I know we're nearing our hour, but all of us know about the flag, and then, of course, the recent brouhaha of the First Man movie where they weren't going to show planting the flag in the movie. We all probably know that story, but you've got information in the book that a flag almost didn't make it on the mission. So that one was news to me too.
Well, it's kind of remarkable that NASA hadn't planned any kind of celebration of arriving at the moon. You know, if you're going to make it to the North Pole, if you're going to make it to the top of Denali, if you're going to make it to the top of Mount Everest, you're going to pause a moment and say, "Wow, look what we did!" And typically, you then plant a flag especially if you're the first one there from a particular nation. NASA hadn't done anything like that, even as late as April, just you know whatever it was, 12, 14 weeks from taking off for the moon. Everything was planned, but no celebration. And somebody sort of noticed this. A bunch of phone calls were made, and on April 1, there was a meeting of the committee to celebrate the first lunar landing. NASA formed a committee, and Neil Armstrong was an ex officio member of the committee. And a kind of hidden figure who turns out to have incredible skills and be incredibly important, a guy named Jack Kinzler, was asked to come to the meeting. He was head of technical support services in Mission Control in Houston. And he came with two ideas. He came with the idea for the plaque, and he had mocked up a plaque. And he came with the idea for a flag. And he said, look, when you go somewhere like this for the first time, human beings plant a flag. We must plant a flag. And he had already come up with this ingenious design where there were really two flagpoles. There was the vertical flagpole, and then hinged to it at the top was a kind of horizontal flagpole, a kind of curtain rod flagpole. And they flew to the moon folded together like tent poles. And then when you got to the moon, the astronauts lifted up the horizontal pole and it latched into place. And then you simply slid the flag out. It was hemmed along the top. You slid it out just like a curtain. In fact, Jack Kinzler said, I was inspired by the fact that my mom made curtains when I was a kid. That's where the idea came from. It was so late in the game, the flag was an off-the-shelf flag. It cost $5. And I'm sure many in your audience will know that the astronauts, when they were on the moon, there were actually checklists of what they were supposed to be doing on the lunar surface. NASA really believes in scripting your time. Don't fall behind. And it was so late in the game that planting the flag isn't on the checklist because everything had been planned out. So Kinzler comes up with this idea. NASA loves it. They scramble to test the contraption that he makes to make sure there's nothing unexpected that will damage the mission. And then Kinzler's shop in Houston created it and created all the subsequent ones, and he actually was put on a Gulfstream jet with his flag just a couple days before the launch of Apollo 11, and then he supervised the mounting of it. It was clipped to the ladder on the lunar module. But it is just amazing. The next day after the moon landing, July 21st, I went through literally hundreds of newspaper front pages, which you can do relatively easily on the internet, thank goodness now. And I would say that half the newspapers in America, the key image from that first moon landing is Armstrong and Aldrin, or Armstrong or Aldrin with the flag. The American flag is sort of this vivid spot on the front pages of America. And it went on to, of course, become one of the key images, and it hadn't even occurred to NASA. And so it's a totally lighthearted moment, you know, but it's just a reminder that even when you're brilliant at planning everything, you can leave something that ultimately seems important out. And just a great story. Nice to be able to write about a guy like Jack Kinzler.
I know we've left a lot of stories out about your book, which is really fascinating and not like all the other Apollo books that are out there. Before we leave, what have we left out that we absolutely should have focused on or talked about?
You know, I think there's two things I want to make sure I leave your listeners with. One is the big myth about Apollo, the big sort of conventional wisdom that I think is wrong, is that Apollo had no impact, that it was a brilliant one-off performance by the United States, an engineering and technical triumph, but it led nowhere. That's not true. The especially the computer work that was necessary to get human beings to the moon, Apollo was the first organization of any kind in the world to use integrated circuits, to use computer chips. Apollo, MIT, and NASA taught the computer chip company how to do the work that we rely on now. And so there's a little sort of tinge of disappointment that Apollo didn't open the solar system to human exploration and settlement. We don't picnic on the moon. We don't do our PhD research on Mars. But you know what? Apollo had a much more dramatic impact back on Earth that has mostly gone unaccounted for. Apollo laid the foundation for the digital age in a very real fashion, not a sort of fictional soft fashion. They taught the technology companies how to create the technology that we rely on. And so I think the 50th anniversary is a great moment to take a step back and say, wait a minute, we have missed the impact. This isn't spin-off. This is literally impact that this had back on society. And the second thing is, look, we still use the phrase, if we could put a man on the moon, why can't we ... You know, if we could go to the moon, why can't we solve fill in the problem that you think
right.
we should be able to solve? We actually use that phrase as much today as we did in the 60s and 70s and 80s. It is still a measure of human achievement to have gone to the moon and human frustration that if we could do that, here's a whole set of problems we haven't solved. And so what was so striking to me, especially given that I focused back on Earth, the astronauts are really wonderful figures and they are incredible characters, but most of us are not, in fact, high-performance fighter jet pilots, right?
Right.
So it should be a little hard to identify with them. The people who did the work to get us to the moon, those people were ordinary Americans, and they will be the first to tell you that they were ordinary. They were called upon to do something that was extraordinary, and they did. They will tell you also, all of them say the same thing, we did it together. I wasn't extraordinary myself. It was all of us working together. And so when you sort of dive in and learn a little bit about that, what you realize is Americans like to be told something's impossible and then fix it and then do it and then prove that it wasn't impossible. And so we have all kinds of problems that we're facing today, and climate change is clearly the most urgent. And we are perfectly capable of tackling those problems and fixing them, conquering them, just like they invented space travel in 8 years in the 1960s. If somebody would rally us to a cause, we will do it. We love to rise to the occasion. And so I think the story has a little, more than a little, has lessons like that in it, which is, oh, this was a heroic thing that we did, but the people who did it weren't superheroes. They were just like us today. And so if there's something we need to do, we too can do it.
What's in store for you for your next book?
I wish I could tell you. Right now, this you mentioned that the Walmart effect and the Big Thirst were New York Times bestsellers. This book is already a New York Times bestseller. It made the bestseller list after its first week, so it has really caught the attention of both space people and I think non-space people as well. And so with the anniversary coming, July 20th, I was actually invited by the Kennedy Center, by the National Symphony, to join them in their Apollo 11 celebration concert on the night of July 20th. So I'm going to dust off my black tuxedo, and I will be on stage at the Kennedy Center. It's amazing what a rocket ride can get you. It's going to get me onto stage at the Kennedy Center, which I never would have imagined. I'm just going to work on telling the story. As you can tell, as I hope your listeners can tell, I think the story of going to the moon is a wonderful tale, and I think there are lots of pieces of it that people will find incredibly intriguing and incredibly amusing, and that haven't been told so many times. So I think through the end of the year, I'm just going to tell the Apollo story to any venue that will have me, and I'll worry about what's next come January.
It is a terrific story, and you've really added to it because you're telling us things or showing us things that maybe a lot of us, I certainly admit to not having known much of what you talk about. And it's a great read and a wonderful book, and it makes Apollo that much more special, especially since I lived through it and had no clue what was going on behind the scenes that you talk about in the book.
Well, that's right. That's what's fun. What's fun is to bring a little freshness to it. And let's just flag your readers. There's 100 pages of footnotes in small type at the end. So if you want to track down where I learned these little stories, every one of them, I source back every one of them, so you can go read the original L.A. Times story about the parachute packers if you want to.
Are you making book tours? Can people find you and get autographed copies?
They sure can, although it's really episodic. I am in Seattle, Washington today, which is Friday, June 28th. I will be in, where will I be? I will be in Cambridge, Massachusetts, St. Louis, Cambridge, Massachusetts at Harvard Bookstore, St. Louis at the St. Louis Public Library, Princeton at the Princeton Public Library. So those are venues that are coming up and easy to find me. And I'm on Twitter at CFISHMAN, C Fishman, and I always tweet out where I'm headed next in case somebody's out there who wants to join me.
Okay. And it's available on Amazon and bookstores as usual, correct?
It's available on Amazon. It's in your local bookstore. For people who feel like they want to read it but are not sure they want to put out yet $20 more for another hardcover book, it is in libraries. Library Journal said to its readers of professional librarians, this is an Apollo book you will want to add to your collection. So it'll be in libraries all around the country, and I love a good library.
I would concur that you would want this in your collection. Charles, this has been a delight, and it's been really fun getting to know you and talking to you, and I will certainly follow your work going forward and look forward to talking to you some more about space and other things that may be of interest, too. It's a fascinating book.
I appreciate that. Let me tell your readers one more thing, which
okay.
We should have mentioned. I am actually writing 50 stories about this period, stories just like this, about the race to the moon, one a day, every day from June 1 to July 20th. And those are being posted on the magazine I work for, fastcompany.com. The series is tagged on Twitter as 50 Days to the Moon. And I would say about half of those stories aren't in the book. So there's a whole fresh wave of stories coming from me. You can read those every single day. It doesn't cost any money. 50 Days to the Moon at fastcompany.com. And so if you want to dip in but not actually add the hardcover to your collection, which I would like you to do, there's lots of fun stuff right there. And we've accumulated them all. So if you dip in today or tomorrow and you like what you read there, there's a link to take you to all of them. 50 Days to the Moon at Fast Company.
I will make sure all of that information is in the archive. And I thank you again. This has been a delight, and your book has been really great. I've really appreciated it and still reading it and enjoyed reading it very much. I will get this archived hopefully later today, California time, or this evening, and I'll send you all of that information as well. And thank you for your great work and also for sharing it with us on the Space Show.
Thanks so much for having me, David. I really enjoyed it. You asked great questions.
Thank you very much. Listeners, back on Sunday. So we thank Charles Fishman for being with us. Goodbye from Charles, David, and the Space Show.